three pieces. And what I'd like to do is convince you that, or explain the interesting science we can do by stacking large numbers of binary events and looking at them not as individual detections with gravitational waves, but as an ensemble, and what physics and astrophysics we can extract from many events. And I'm going to begin with, not with the events that we've seen so far, the nearest events, which are in the most nearby universe, but I'm going to go back a little bit further into the age of the universe, and we'll kind of kick things off imagining that we're working with advanced LIGO and advanced Virgo in a year or two, and we have dozens or maybe a couple hundred events. This will be the first part of the talk. What can we do with hundreds of events? But then we'll go further back in the history of the universe and talk about the events, the coalescences that are too far away for LIGO or high frequency future 3G detectors to see. These are the unresolved binaries, and these are the source of the astrophysical foreground that we heard about in Latham's talk. And then in part three, we'll go back even further to the primordial backgrounds from the very early universe. And if there's time, I'll talk a little bit about sky localization, which has nothing to do with the other topics, but Dennis asked me to be ready to talk about it, and so I'm happy to oblige if there's time. I should mention that none of this is really particular to high-frequency detectors per se, but I'll try to point out connections as we go, and I think that the general program of looking at the science of ensembles of gravitational wave events is the future of gravitational wave astronomy, whatever band you're interested in. So why do I say that? Well, every 200 seconds, somewhere in the universe, a pair of black holes merge. So this is something that we even can infer based on the fact that in the local universe, out to Z of 0.1, we see, you know, half a dozen binary black hole mergers in the published LIGO-Virgo papers so far. Based on the fact that we've seen one binary neutron star merger, we know that roughly every 13 seconds, a pair of neutron stars merge somewhere in the universe. Now, as Alberto pointed out, this is uncertain to, you know, maybe it could be twice as big or 10 times as low, but to within an order of magnitude, we have some idea of just how many events there are out there in the integrated over the entire history of star formation. And it works out to about 100,000 binary black hole events that would be in audio band per year, and about 2 million binary neutron star events. So we've only just scratched the surface with the six detections that we've published so far. Rana pointed out in his talk that in some sense, individual detections are already getting boring. We will always continue to highlight very interesting events. So if we see something that's more massive than any other binary we've seen so far, this will probably get its own paper. Or if we see a binary that's highly eccentric or has unusual spin properties, these will warrant attention. But increasingly, the most interesting physics and astrophysics is going to come from looking at ensembles as we start to get lots of events. And already with second generation detectors, we are expecting 100 to 200 events per year at design sensitivity. And you can do quite a lot with that. So this is to motivate the first part of my talk, which is what kind of science can you do when you have hundreds, or in the case of 3G detectors, thousands of tens of thousands of resolvable events that you can clearly detect. And there are tons of things that I could talk about, and we could fill up the entire hour giving just an overview of population inference science, and this would be great. But I'm not going to do that. I'll just mention some of the different topics that are really exciting in the field right now, and then I'll pick one of these to focus on as a case study. So, briefly, one thing that's getting a lot of attention right now is formation mechanisms of binary black holes. We could talk about binary neutron stars as well. But here the idea is that if you look at a lot of binary black hole systems and you look at their ensemble properties, you can use their mass and spin distribution or eccentricity distribution to say something about how they formed in the first place and what kind of channels lead to the formation of black holes that merge with black hole binaries that merge within a Hubble time. We've heard a lot in this workshop already about nuclear state physics with binary neutron star mergers. Implicit in our discussion is this idea of stacking. When we draw a mass radius diagram and we say that we want to calculate the equation of states and see which one of these equations of states is the one that describes nuclear matter, that at high densities, we're implicitly imagining that we have a large number of events. Each one of them will have some fuzz on a mass radius diagram because it will have uncertainty associated with it. But we're imagining putting them on this mass radius diagram and kind of seeing out what equation of state path they trace. There have also been interesting work recently on stacking to do post-merger physics and to even look at things like how magnetic fields decay in neutron stars. We've discussed during kind of the open sessions some of the beyond general relativity work or tests of GR that can be done with gravitational waves. And this is all improved by stacking. So if you have one loud event, sure, you can test the no-hair theorem. You can test Hawking's area theorem. You can do black hole spectroscopy and look if the quasi-normal modes are in the right place. But if you have hundreds of events and you stack them, you can do much better than you can with any single event. And of course, as the number of detections increases, you'll be able to have more and more precise tests of GR. In Latham's talk, we heard a little bit about the kinds of cosmology that can be done with various gravitational wave detectors. Advanced LIGO and Virgo already have a very nice paper out in Nature measuring the Hubble parameter for the first time with gravitational waves. This is going to just continue to blossom into a big field. In addition to Hubble, people are talking about using gravitational waves to do lensing. I think that there's a lot of rich science out there in gravitational wave cosmology. And this, of course, involves looking at lots of events. You can't get the Hubble parameter from a single detection. But what I'm going to focus on in our first part of this talk today is stellar astrophysics. So what can we learn about massive stars by looking at gravitational waves from binary black holes and binary neutron stars? And I'm going to focus even more specifically. So we'll drill down really onto a specific topic so I can give you I want to give you a flavor of the kinds of astrophysics that I see being increasingly important as we think about what we're looking for in a 3G detector. We should be thinking partly about what we can do when we have bazillions of events. So here's our case study, parent stability supernova and pulsational parent stability supernova. To explain why this is interesting, we have to talk about what happens to massive stars when they die. So if a star is born with something greater than 80 solar masses, zero age main sequence, it's a fairly unusual star in terms of how massive it is. And it will become so hot eventually as it ages that it will eventually reach temperatures where you can create E plus E minus pairs in the core. And this is the beginning of pair production. When the star starts pair producing, you think about it, you have this very these very high energy photons that carry a lot of kinetic energy. Scatter and produce E plus E minus, you're suddenly taking kinetic energy out of the star and turning it into mass that's moving less quickly. And this causes this reduces the pressure in the star and causes the star to contract. The contraction of the star heats up and leads to a runaway process, making more E plus E minus, taking more pressure out of the star. And if the star is sufficiently massive, if it's more than 130 solar masses, zero age main sequence, this leads to a runaway process which completely disrupts the star and causes a pair instability supernova. Pair instability supernova are thought to be superluminous supernova, so brighter than average core collapse supernova. There are some candidate pair instability supernova events, but not ones that there's unambiguous evidence for them. And these disruptions leave behind no remnant. So we expect no black holes and therefore no gravitational waves after a pair instability supernova. But if the star is a little bit less massive than 130 solar masses, let's say between 80 and 130 solar masses, it undergoes a different kind of pair instability event. It undergoes PPSN, which is short for pulsational pair instability supernovae. In PPSN, what happens is you have E plus E minus production, but it's not a runaway process to the point that the entire star is disrupted. Rather, the first thing that happens is the star ejects the envelope, so you just have a naked core sitting by itself. And this is sufficient to relieve the pressure and turn off pair production. If the core is really massive, it can start heating up again, though, and continue to eject mass in a series of pulses. And each one of these pulses creates another pulsational pair instability supernova. But ultimately, if the star is in this 80 to 130 solar mass range, you eventually reach a state as a core with just about 40 solar masses, and this core will not disrupt from pair production. Instead, it eventually just ends a normal, conventional core collapse, and you make a black hole, which is around 40 solar masses. Now, this picture that we have, which is at this point largely theoretical, people who study massive stars believe that this happens, but we're not sure about this. We have a prediction. So if the massive stars that are really big leave no black holes, and if ones that are just underneath that get reduced in mass, we expect that if you look at the black hole mass spectrum, there should be a cutoff at the end, and then a pileup. And the pileup happens because all the things that you're following some power law here, and this, by the way, is the probability density of getting a black hole, the primary black hole inside a black hole binary. So the primary is the more massive of the two black holes. This should follow a power law out to infinity, but there's some cutoff, and above here, nothing gets made. And then between here and here, you smush all that power law up, and you scrunch it up, and you make a peak. So this is a kind of cartoon, then, of what we think the black hole mass spectrum might look like for the primary black hole and a black hole binary. You have some minimum mass where you start to make black holes, then you follow some power law, and the power law is there just because the mass of stars follows a power law, and this is inherited into black holes. And then you get some peak, but we don't know exactly where this peak will be. Here it's at 35 solar masses, but this is dependent on unknown details of pair instability supernova physics. And it has some width associated with it, which encodes the uncertainty in pair instability supernova, but we don't know where this is either. And then there's some unknown cutoff. And people like Stan Woosley tell us that all this stuff happens at around 35, 40 solar masses, but this is not known. And this plot, I have a picture of this gentleman here, Colm Talbot, because I wanted to recognize that he's the one who led this paper. He's my student. There's also a paper on this topic that's very nice by Maya Fischbach and Dan Holtz at the University of Chicago.
I have a question. So I think you mentioned that there's some uncertainty in this distribution. So I think some research groups try to speculate that there are either some primordial black hole, you would also see some peaks in this distribution. So how can you distinguish those if you really get a peak, like you say, oh, that's from my model, or that's from primordial black holes?
So that would be hard. I would say that if you saw this peak in your black hole mass spectrum, and if it occurred at about the right place for a pulsational pair instability supernova peak, the most economical Occam factor interpretation would be that it's from pulsational pair instability supernova because you don't have to invoke somewhat new physics to attribute it to primordial black holes. But it wouldn't be a smoking gun signature for PPSN. So what you would probably want to do to make it smoking gun is go out and look for electromagnetic counterparts that are consistent with the rate. So seeing this tells you something about the rate of pulsational pair instability supernova events. You should be able to match this on. Maybe you can do other things too, and say, look at the events here and see if they have spins that are the spins you would expect from PPSN black holes. But it's not obvious how you would do it, to me.
Yeah, because you see, after the first detection, when the solar mass is also around 30 for black holes, then people speculate these are the primordial black holes. So then also the argument was, if there is a peak around 30, 35 solar mass, then you see there's a primordial black hole. But this idea is now a mechanism.
I can insert a rant here about primordial black hole interpretation of the 1509-14, but this could lead us astray. What do you folks want?
Please.
You want the rant?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so as far as I know, there's no you know, fundamental physics motivation to put the scale of the mass scale for dark matter primordial black holes at tens of solar masses. There is an observational window in which there are not strong constraints that made it, if you squint and pray, possible that you could have had dark matter be explained by primordial black holes that happened to be right where 1509-14 was, but you wouldn't a priori, from fundamental physics reasons, think that that would be where you would make lots of black holes. Why, when you make more massive black holes than that, you disrupt wide binaries. When you make less massive black holes than this, you screw up microlensing constraints. And then even at 30 solar masses, you are ruled out as being all of the dark matter because you screw up X-ray flux. You make too many primordial black holes that stuff accretes onto them, and they would lead to X-ray observations that we don't see. So people argue away the X-rays and say that, you know, oh, maybe these limits are wrong. But if there are primordial black holes, I don't think they account for the dark matter. All right. So what we would like to do, we have this prediction from astrophysics that we should be able to see, we learn stuff about stars from looking at the spectrum of black hole masses that detectors like LIGO observe. And so how do we do this? Well, the first thing that we're going to do is we're going to parameterize this mass spectrum we looked at in the previous slide. And everything I'm talking about here is the general way one approaches these population problems. So the way, and a bit of pedagogy, when we parameterize the distribution of the black holes, or if you're talking about binary neutron stars, these are referred to in the field as hyperparameters. And the reason is because the word parameters is what we use to describe the properties of individual compact binaries. So one compact binary has primary mass and a secondary mass and some inclination angle. Those are the parameters for that event. But the hyperparameters, things like what is the spectral index of the black hole mass distribution, are things that describe the population of black holes. So when we talk about measuring those properties, we're going to talk about hyperparameters. And there's a framework which I'm just going to not even talk about, but people can ask if you're interested during Q&A, of hierarchical Bayesian inference, which is the formalism to estimate the posterior distributions for these hyperparameters using standard inference techniques. So let's go back to our plot, and now let's think about it now, not as a cartoon, but as a hyperparameterized model of the black hole mass spectrum. So starting from left to right, these are the hyperparameters that Olem and I introduced in order to try to measure this PPSN peak. So we have a minimum mass here, which is an unknown parameter. This is the minimum mass, black hole mass that you can make. This is something that second generation, current generation of detectors have no hope of measuring because of selection effects. It's really hard to measure these low mass black holes. So this is the kind of thing that a high frequency detector could measure, and is actually really interesting thing to measure. You can learn about the mass gap between black hole systems and neutron star systems. But we can't see it in our analysis. Then there's some turn-on length, which parameterizes how quickly you get up to the power law. And then there's a power law index, which we don't assume to be the same as the power law index that describes the mass distribution of stars, because there's some, it basically, it could change through stellar evolution. And then we parameterize the end of the distribution by saying that there's some unknown maximum mass where this distribution cuts off. There's some peak, which has is described by Gaussian, which has a mean MPP for pulsational pair, sigma PP, which is the width, and then lambda, which is the height of this normal distribution. And finally, not pictured, we need to somehow say something about the secondary, the lighter black hole in the system. And we say that the distribution for the probability density for the secondary black hole mass is conditional on the primary mass, and it's described by some power law beta, some power index beta. And then we're going to estimate these. Question?
That's true. So given that you measure binaries, is mass transfer something that you need to worry about?
Yes. So if your binaries are formed in the field, which is to say that they are created from stars that were themselves binaries, then the evolution is going to be the mass products you get are complicated. They won't be the same mass distribution that you would get from stars that form an isolation. So everything I said about what the cartoon of what we think the pulsational pair instability peak looks like and what the black hole mass spectrum ought to look like still should hold if you have binary evolution based on what I know. So basically, you would start in a binary with two stars that are roughly comparable mass, because massive stars are preferentially found in nearly equal mass systems. And then you would have mass transfer. So one of them, the slightly more massive one, would undergo its giant expansion first and transfer mass onto the other, but it would ultimately undergo PPSN if it's big enough and make a 40 solar mass, 35 solar mass remnant. But now the other one has gained mass through mass transfer, and it was over the PPSN limit to begin with anyway, so it will undergo PPSN and leave a 40 solar mass black hole. But there are people who do population synthesis and try to model all this stuff and common envelope evolution. It's really complicated.
So this mass ratio distribution, is it just how you parameterize it?
Yes. It's not a lot of physics went into that. It's just to try to make sure that the what we're really interested in is this. And we want to give enough freedom here so that we don't falsely see a peak that's just due to our lack of knowledge about that. But if you knew something, you had a better model, this could be improved, I think. All right, so the next step then is to do an analysis with Monte Carlo data. And here we're looking again at the distribution of the primary mass, the heavy black hole and the binary. And let's start by looking at the blue histogram. The blue histogram is showing the true value of the mass, the distribution of the true value of the mass that was injected into our detector for 200 simulated events. And you can see that they kind of flat, and then you get some peak here. And they're drawn from this black distribution, which is the underlying parent distribution describing the black hole mass in your detector. I would like to point out, though, and this is quite interesting, that the mass distribution that you observe in your detector is very different from the mass distribution out there in nature. And that's because of a very strong selection effect. Massive systems are much easier to detect because they make much higher gravitational wave strains. So you can see them further away and you see more of them. So this solid black line, that's what you see in your detector. This dashed distribution is what's out there in nature. You can see how different they are. There's this huge, most black holes out there in nature are here at 5 or 10 solar masses. But after 200 events, you would expect many more at the high mass range, with assuming you have a peak here, because you preferentially detect your higher mass objects. And this the selection effect has to be taken into account when you do hierarchical modeling. So if you turn the crank on the Bayesian inference, you get a plot that looks like this. Here is a posterior distribution for those 200 events we looked at. And let's just focus on this one panel. This is a posterior distribution for mu, which is the center of that Gaussian, that peak where you have the PPSN pileup, and sigma is the width of that PPSN peak. And this is pretty interesting. You see that after 200 events, you can measure the location of the PPSN peak to within about 2 solar masses, and you can see the width of it to within about, let's say, 1 solar mass. This now, as another pair of posterior distributions, let's just focus on this one on the left side. Lambda is the height of the PPSN peak. And this one is peaking at 0.1. But the key thing I want to show you here is that it's excluded zero. And this is what a detection of a PPSN peak looks like in Bayesian inference. You exclude zero with high confidence, which means that your data demand the model with a peak in it. And because the peak is the signature of PPSN within your Bayesian inference, you're saying that my data have a strong preference for explaining this in terms of some peak rather than not having a peak. You can then, using your measurements of the hyperparameters, reconstruct what the actual mass distribution looked like. And these are called posterior predictive distributions. Here are a bunch of them. So this is, again, probability density and mass, primary mass. And there are a bunch of different colors. And what the different colors show you are different numbers of hyperparameters. So you can start with a very simple model that is just a power law with no cutoff and no turn on and no peak. And if you do that, you get something that's totally wrong. But as you add complexity to your model, as long as your complexity is good complexity that's needed to fit the model, you start to get better fits. And that's when you start to get this PPSN peak. You not only do you see the peak, which is telling you stellar astrophysics that you didn't already know, you're also getting a much more accurate measure of the power law index for things that are outside of the peak. This more or less concludes the first part of my talk. I'll end this part by saying that this method is currently being used along with some other hierarchical modeling techniques in O1 and O2 data LIGO's first and second observing runs. There's a paper coming out from the LIGO collaboration in about a month or 2 months, I'm hoping, that will show with all of the events that have been detected so far, what we can say about parent stability supernova.
So I was wondering about the cutoff of the power law at high masses. So I assume, you know, if you went to much higher masses, then again, LIGO would not be able to see it because it's too low frequency. So can you say anything about whether or not this power law actually cuts off at high enough masses or whether it could continue on to even higher black holes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So you definitely have to pick up again because we see supermassive black holes and they have to have been made from somewhere. So the story doesn't end with disruption events. And in fact, if you keep going and piling on more mass and making bigger and bigger stars, at some point you stop making parent stability supernova and you just direct collapse. The pressure is so great that you can't pair produce your way out of it. So and then going up to really high, hundreds of solar masses, you start to just make black holes again. And I think they do get so massive that they start to come out of the range of LIGO, but I'm guessing off the top of my head that we could probably catch the ring down of those things merging, particularly if they're merging with a lighter black hole, maybe, depending on the mass. And you're asking if the power law connects them? I have no idea.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, like, you know, you had the cutoff at, like, around 35 or 40 solar masses. Just wondering if you could say whether or not this power law part actually continues from 40 to 100, say, solar masses, or just because of the...
I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. And I don't think we know where the black hole mass spectrum picks up again and what the rate is of these intermediate mass black holes is highly uncertain. But it's a really interesting question. All right, so now we're going to move on. Remember in the first part of the talk, we were looking at dozens, hundreds, thousands of events and what we can do with what astrophysics we can do with them. And we looked at parent stability supernova as a case study to try to get into this idea of valuing large numbers of events intrinsically for what they can tell us from populations. We're now going to go out further and look at more distant events. And I have this picture here of my collaborator, Rory Smith. He's singing on television about black holes. He's chirping. This part of the talk is from a paper that we did together last year. So all of the detectors that we've been talking about over today and yesterday all leave some binaries unresolved, except for Big Bang Observer. It's the one detector you can build that basically sees every single binary in the entire universe. But unless we're talking about Big Bang Observer, your detector has an astrophysical foreground associated with it, because there's some distance. Maybe you'll see all binary black holes in the universe if you build Einstein telescope. But there's some distance beyond which you will not see binary neutron stars, because they're too weak, and you need to build BBO to see all of them. And this will create, inevitably, an astrophysical foreground of stochastic gravitational waves. And this is interesting for a number of reasons. For one thing, it gets in the way of trying to get to the primordial ones, which are the primordial background. But it's also intrinsically interesting in its own right, because by definition, the stochastic background from weak binaries is these are the most distant sources that your detector can probe. So we ought to value them for their own right, because if we can extract some properties about them, it will tell us about the most distant events in the universe. It will tell us about the earliest compact objects in the universe. We can compare that to the local population. So how do we do this? Well, the goal is to we're going to talk about how the correct way to think about unresolvable binary populations and how to look for them. And our framework will be to develop a unified treatment that treats unresolved binaries and the background that they create as the same way that we think about resolved binaries. There will be a number of advantages to thinking about them this way. So before I get into what the new method that we're proposing, a new framework for thinking about this, let's take one slide to talk about the old or the sort of standard way of thinking about searching for stochastic backgrounds of gravitational waves. The standard method, which was really developed explained elegantly by Bruce Allen and Joe Romano, is cross-correlation. And the basic idea is you need two detectors. You take data from these two detectors, you Fourier transform it, and you multiply the Fourier transforms together to make a cross-power spectral density. Then you just average this cross-power spectral density. And by averaging, if the noise in the two detectors is uncorrelated, which is a great assumption, over time, you start to dig below the instantaneous noise in each detector. And eventually, you're able to hopefully pull out some weak correlated signal, which is present in both detectors, that, and which you can't see at any, you know, if you looked at just the noise curve. And Allen and Romano showed that this strategy is an optimal strategy if your background that you're looking for is Gaussian and stationary. But it's highly suboptimal for non-Gaussian processes like binary black hole coalescences or binary neutron star coalescences. And yes?
You said something very interesting by saying it's highly suboptimal. But I've heard many, you know, conversation within LIGO, okay, where there's been mock data challenges, etc., that have been, and I've heard, and I would like you to tell me whether I'm completely wrong, etc., that still the standard, search does sufficiently well within 10 or 20%, even when you have non-Gaussian backgrounds. And I never understood why that's the case. So am I getting something completely wrong? Have people said something wrong?
I will argue that this is an incorrect folk wisdom, and that there, in fact, the optimal method is about 1,000 times faster to time to detection than the cross-correlation search. And I will back this up with...
People have been saying really wrong things on calls and emails, okay?
I think so. I think that people for a long time didn't solve the right problem, didn't ask the right question. And Well, I'll say what I think the right way to do it is, and then I'll try to back it up by showing some plots. But I'll also appeal to your sense of intuition. So we know that binaries have this very specific waveform morphology, and cross-correlation knows nothing about that. We know that binaries happen very intermittently and aren't there most of the time. How could a likelihood function that doesn't know about any of this stuff possibly do as well as a likelihood function that builds into it the wave, the very, very specific signal morphology that we're looking for and knows about the fact that they're intermittent? This should already tell us that the folk wisdom is probably wrong. Although I guess there's the question of how wrong, how good of an approximation it is. But it certainly should seem suspicious. But then if I'm going to stand here and say the cross-correlation method is so suboptimal for these backgrounds, this then asks the question, well, okay, so what is the optimal search? And this was the question that Rory Smith and I built our paper around, this one down here. And this is what I think is the right way to think about these sub-threshold events that are beyond the resolving power of your detector. So here is a little outline of how one carries out this alternative search, which we call the Bayesian search, just for historical reasons. There are a lot of okay. So we begin by dividing the data into segments. And for black holes, we're going to make these segments 4 seconds long. This is kind of just a data handling step, but for us, it's just convenient. We want to make these segments long enough that a black hole binary sits nicely inside a segment. So if a black hole binary is tenths of a second long, 4 seconds is nice, that it's not likely we're going to get one on the edge, which requires a little bit more sophistication to handle. We also don't want to make them so long that we get two binary black holes in one segment too often, because this is another complication that one can handle, but it makes the math a little bit more annoying. Then on each one of these 4 second segments, we're going to run parameter estimation. Now, parameter estimation is like a Markov chain Monte Carlo or a nested sampling tool that is what we, in LIGO and Virgo, run on data after we've had a detection. So for the non-LIGO people in the room, if you've seen a posterior distribution of the masses of a binary or the spin, these are all generated by parameter estimation code that's sort of solving this inverse problem of what parameters the data have given the data. But it also, you know, we think of it as giving you these pretty plots, but it also gives you a Bayesian evidence. And the Bayesian evidence is an integral of the likelihood multiplied by the prior over all of your parameter space. And you can then take the signal evidence and compare it to the noise evidence and create a Bayes factor. And this Bayes factor is an optimal indicator of how much signal there is in your data, because it's folding in all of the information you know over the entire parameter space about whether this was more like a binary signal or more like noise. So our strategy is going to be, instead of starting with cross power spectra, which is the how you begin the cross correlation search and which throws away the phase information, our raw input into our analysis is going to be these evidences, which by construction you know about all the phase evolution of a binary system. And we're going to combine them into a likelihood. I think this is the only equation in my slides. So it's a very, no, there's one more, sorry. It's a very kind of heavy statistics, but this is the essence of it. We have some likelihood function here, which is the likelihood for getting some set of data, which consists of many 4 second segments, given some parameters xi. Xi is what we're trying to measure. I'm going to keep talking about it for the next few slides. Xi is the fraction of segments in your year of data that contain a binary event in them. And so this is what we're trying to construct. Ignore this product for a moment and just look at everything to the right of it. The right-hand side of this equation is just a conditional likelihood. You're saying that, well, there are two things that my data could have. It could be signal or it could be noise. So there's some probability xi that I have signal, in which case my likelihood is given by the signal evidence. And then if it's not signal, it must be noise. And the probability that it branches to that is 1 minus xi. So these are my two possibilities. And this zs, that's the signal evidence, that's just what parameter estimation gives you. It's a number that your MCMC chains return. And Zn is just another number that parameter estimation gives you. So if that's the likelihood for one event, if you have, or one segment, if you have little n segments, you can just take the product of these, and instead of thinking of Xi as a probability, you can reinterpret it as the fraction of events in your data that contain a signal. And in this Bayesian framework, the way that you detect a stochastic background is you exclude Xi. Your posterior distribution excludes Xi equals zero. When you exclude Xi equals zero, you're saying that my data are best explained by the hypothesis that some non-zero fraction of the data contain a binary signal. And Xi is a kind of data analyst's variable, but we'd like to convert it into something astrophysical. And indeed, you can with a trivial model. It has a one-to-one mapping onto energy density, omega GW, due to binaries. Or you can turn it into like a local rate, an effective local coalescence rate. So that's the high-level summary of the method. The next step is to apply it to some simulated data and show that it actually works. So we did a simulation. We made 300 of these four-second segments for two data sets. The first data set is just pure Gaussian noise, colored to look like advanced LIGO at design sensitivity. The second data set consisted of Gaussian noise and a signal. I'm going to keep calling it the signal data set, even though it has noise in it, just to distinguish it from the noise data set. In the signal data set, we have randomly chosen binary black holes, and each one of them is too weak to be resolved independently. So none of these would be detections. And we ensure that by throwing out anything we pick that has a signal-to-noise ratio, a network signal-to-noise ratio greater than 12, which is the threshold for a gold-plated detection with a two-detector network. We draw events randomly, uniform in volume, from 500 megaparsecs to 5 gigaparsecs, although in a recent follow-up project with colleagues in LIGO, we've now extended this out to 30 gigaparsecs. Here are some additional details about our choices of distributions for our binaries that I'll skip over, but the experts in the room can note them.
Eric, I have a question.
Yes.
I remember a couple of years ago there was an issue that some of the data analysis people were worried that we detected a very strong show signal, but after a few months of observations, we didn't really detect any like low SNR, like SNR of 2 or 3. Do you know the situation kind of improved?
So there was a great email from Bruce Allen, which is probably still in everyone's inbox, and it's like almost like a little paper, so it's worth reading. But after 1509-14, people asked, is it weird that we had our first event is so loud? Shouldn't you expect that conventional folk wisdom is that you get so many more events on the edge of your visible volume, shouldn't you have seen some barely visible event? And he was bothered by this, and he just worked through the math, and it's not so weird, is the punchline. So you can calculate the probability of getting something loud, and it's, you know, 1.5 sigma weird, but not so weird. There's just a lot of variability. And then, so as far as I know, there was never a real problem to be addressed. Just it looked weird, but it wasn't actually on scrutiny. Yes.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, so I would guess that if you do parameter estimation on a low SNR event, then it's going to be very sensitive to your priors, right? When you try to estimate like the mass and the spin and things like that. Do you find that?
For some things, yes. So let's see. If your mass, if your mass or your distance distributions are significantly wrong, then you infer the wrong value of Xi. So, you know, if you, for example, if you assume that they're uniformly distributed, not in comoving volume, but in like volume constructed from luminosity distance, but they're in fact, so you just, your cosmology is wrong, you will estimate the wrong value of Xi. But you don't get detections where there are none. You just get a bias in your inferred energy density or Xi parameter. You can fix this by hyperparameterizing your priors. So if you don't know what the real mass distribution is of the black holes, then you go back to the first part of the talk and you put in hyperparameters that describe your uncertainty in that. And then you, after initially calculating your evidence, you can reweight your posterior samples using some recycling technique and say, well, what if I'd run it with all, you know, with a different prior, and I'm going to marginalize over all the different priors I could have had. And in general, your evidence goes down because most of the time, because this is basically injecting additional uncertainty. So yes, you get bias. Yes, you have to be careful, but you can't detect something that's not there by getting the priors wrong. Gaussian noise still looks like Gaussian noise. Those priors are easy ones. And if you are worried about the bias, you can remove that, but it requires some additional modeling.
And about the Gaussian noise, I mean, I think in general, the LIGO noise is not stationary related. So is it stationary in 4 second periods? Is that a good?
I'll come back to that.
Okay.
No is the answer, but I'll come back to it. Last thing on this slide is that I'll just highlight that most of the events in our sample have SNRs of like 3, which would not even be close to detectable.
Eric, can I just ask, why the total mass limited to 48?
Why don't we look at lower mass signals?
Yeah.
There are a couple reasons. Practically, we are using reduced order modeling, which is a technique for speeding up parameter estimation, and it's defined in these like poorly artificial mass ranges. And so one of our reasons for this initial study was we just wanted to look at something that was a computationally easy problem. More astrophysically, as you lower the mass, your signals start to get longer and the rate goes up at the same time. They start to pile up on top of each other. And you can handle this, but it becomes messier. So we wanted to keep the problem simple. Okay. So here is a plot to convince you that when you actually turn the crank on this, it works. There are 3 things we should demand of any new algorithm to search for something. It should be safe, effective, and unbiased. It's kind of like an ad for medication. Here we're looking at posterior distributions for Xi, which, just to remind you, is the fraction of events that contain a binary signal. And if the algorithm is safe, you should be able to give it Gaussian noise with Xi equals 0, and it should peak at Xi equals 0. And indeed, the Peach trace shows that this works. It should be effective, which means that you should be able to give it pure signal, and it should peak at Xi equals 1. And the blue trace shows you that we can do this as well. Unbiased means you should be able to pick something in between, for example, 0.05. And your peak should include the dashed line within its 90% credible interval 90% of the time, and it does. So it works. But what do you gain from doing this? This is the plot to answer the quantitative statement to back up what I said earlier, Alberto. So this is now a plot showing you log base factor on the color axis, which is how significant a detection is. And you want it to get to this blue line where you cross 8. This is like a 4 sigma detection. And then the horizontal axis is the number of segments you've analyzed. So this is just how long you've run your search for. And the vertical axis is the true value of Xi, which is a proxy for signal strength. Smaller values of Xi mean lower rates, and that means lower energy densities, weaker signals. And we find that we can detect this a realistic binary black hole background, which is consistent with the measured BBHs that we've seen so far, with about 1 day of data, less than a day at design sensitivity, whereas we think it would take a few years of cross-correlation in order to get the same result. So this is why I say it's a dramatic improvement. However, you had a great question about glitches. What happens if you now look at real data, though? Because everything I've shown you so far is for Gaussian noise. And indeed, if you apply this algorithm naively, it's to data from the second observing run, but you shift the 2 data streams so that you kind of destroy the coherence of the gravitational wave signals in it, you would want your algorithm to peak at Xi equals 0 because it should look like noise, but it doesn't. It peaks at 0.3 or something like this. So you need to do something to handle glitches. Fortunately, there's a relatively straightforward tweak you can make to make it more robust. It doesn't look straightforward at all, but I promise it is. So you add maybe a couple more terms to the likelihood function. They look really nasty, but they have a simple interpretation. You need to add a glitch model. And your glitch model, you want to be very conservative so that your detection is beyond doubt. So our conservative glitch model is to say that glitches look exactly like compact binary coalescent signals. They're completely indistinguishable. No one would think that this is true, but we're going to make this assumption anyway to try to be as conservative as possible. The only difference between glitches in our glitch model and signals is that they're uncorrelated in the two detectors. So if you have a glitch in Hanford and it has some mass and some direction on the sky, blah, 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 the Livingston detector may have a glitch at the same time, but there's no reason why its mass and its direction and all these properties should be the same. And all these terms are just including new possibilities so that you have, you have all these bifurcating probabilities, and you say, well, maybe there's a glitch, but there's no signal, or maybe there's a glitch in this detector, but no glitch in that detector. But you're still using the same ingredients. You're just enforcing your belief that the signals should be coherent and self-consistent if they're astrophysical, and they should be completely uncorrelated if they're not. And if you make this change, you save the day. So here is the posterior distribution once again for Xi, number of events, fraction of events that are due to signal, and it peaks at zero for Gaussian noise and, for real data. This is O2 data, and it peaks at one if you take O2 data, time shift it, and then dump a bunch of injections in it.
So this is a conservative glitch model. So if the glitch does not look like a real signal, but you still apply this model, will this make this whole thing biased?
No, that's what we're doing here, because the glitches in O2 presumably don't look like CBCs, but you're basically projecting the glitch onto your space's CBC signals and then saying, is it more likely coherent or incoherent? And because glitches are incoherent, even though you take a delta function, it will project on somewhat onto the space of all your CBC templates, but it just doesn't look like any of the things you're looking for. So it doesn't even really widen your posteriors very much to add this, because your algorithms, it's easy for it to tell the difference between glitches and CBC signals.
You can maybe give us a practical example. So some common glitch in Hanford-Livingston. So what is like the space that it covers of, let's say, masses of black holes? Like, what's the range? And also similar for the real signal. Let's say if you expect some SNR of one or two signal, also you probably can project to some range of templates. I'm just wondering what are these ranges in real instruments.
So for this particular analysis, we're looking at 48 to 80 solar masses. So your glitches are going to have all kinds of behavior because they're not related to CBCs. We're just artificially pretending that they're CBCs. So if you have a blip glitch, those are really short ones, right? So this would probably look like a really high mass, to the extent that it looks like any CBC signal, it would be best fit by a high mass ratio, late merger. So it would find that part of parameter space. And if you had really long, slowly evolving things, they would probably look more like VNS. But none of them should really look like CBCs.
When these things turn up in the database, you see like SNR of 300 in Hanford and nothing in Livingston. And you're just like, yeah, that's not real.
Right. And that's that same calculation you do in your head is intuitively is what the likelihood is formalizing. What is the chance that it happened to fall in the dead spot so that it's really loud in Hanford but not in Livingston?
Yeah, just what I remember is that, the loud glitches are very rare, but some SNR of one glitches happen every few seconds.
I'm not sure about, low SNR stuff. I haven't really looked at that.
So evidently, it doesn't couple. This is real data.
Yeah.
So it evidently is orthogonal enough to our signal space that it just doesn't hurt anything. Okay, so running this analysis is computationally more expensive than doing the cross-correlation analysis. The cross-correlation analysis, you can grab a couple hundred cores, hit submit, go to sleep, wake up, and the year of data is done. For this analysis, we estimate that you would need, with current techniques, 500,000 CPU hours to analyze just 20 hours of data. And this works out to be about 3,000 cores running for 1 week. This is way more expensive than the cross-correlation search, but it's also not prohibitive. You can get thousands of cores for a week, so with existing facilities. So we think that this is something that's within reach. We also hope to be able to speed it up through various improvements, yes.
So that is presumably very dependent on the minimum mass of the black holes that are using.
This is all for 48 to 80 solar masses. So this is only high mass black holes. Okay. If you wanted to do this with binary neutron stars, the cost is going to get much more expensive. But I also, I'm optimistic that, you know, over the coming years, we'll be able to push both from the hardware end, looking into GPUs and things like this, and just computers getting better, and from the software algorithm end to do PE faster, that I'm cautiously optimistic that it's not an outrageous thing to think about. But it will it'll be much more expensive. All right. So in addition, I wanted to point out that, well, I haven't talked about it at length in this talk, you can also estimate the hyperparameters of the binary black hole population that you measure, or binary neutron star. We've been focusing at binary black holes because that's the easier problem to solve, but someday this will happen with binary neutron stars. You can do the same thing for high frequency people. And this is pretty cool when you think about it. We're saying that there are some population of binaries out there. You can't see any of them, but you can say something about the mass distribution. Or you can say how they're distributed in distance, but you can't actually see any of them. So this is pretty, it's pretty interesting. And this is, I think this is something that we'll be able to achieve already in second generation detectors. We have some projects coming out on this in the next months. I do think this can be extended to binary neutron star background, so people that are interested in high frequency stuff. It's harder, definitely harder on a number of things are more complicated. I'm happy to talk more about this during Q&A, but it's also, I'm very confident it's solvable. And another interesting thing that you can do is if you're interested in primordial backgrounds from phase transitions or whatever in the early universe, you can use this inference technique to simultaneously measure the foreground and the background at the same time. And I really think that this is the way to go in the future, and there'll be some more work coming out about this, but I'm pretty bullish that you'll be able to dig a lot of the astrophysical foreground away and uncover the background behind it, as long as you have good templates. So that's why post-merger will be hard. But for binary neutron star, binary black hole in spiral and merger, we understand that. I think that we'll get good measurements of the underlying background.
Can I ask? This obviously relies on having two instruments running at the same time. So how much does the relative sensitivity of the two matter? I mean, would it be substantially worse if you used sort of Livingston and Virgo, for example?
That's a good question. For cross-correlation, you're basically dominated by the worst, the crappier of the detectors. The reason is that you can think to some degree as using the better detector as a match filter template, a noisy match filter for the other detector. And then, so you have a template that's itself noisy, and then you're applying it to the worst detector. Here, though, your second detector only needs to be good enough that you can verify whether the thing in the first detector is a glitch. So it needs to be able, if you have something that's SNR 10 in one detector, the other detector needs to say, well, I know that that wasn't a glitch because I would have seen it with SNR 2. If it drops below that threshold, then it won't work at all. You'll be limited by the lower detector.
I mean, I think you can extend this technique to use a network of three and more.
Of course.
Yeah. Do you have a sense of how it scales?
Not quantitatively. I don't think. I don't think anything dramatic will happen. I think maybe the if you converted the Bayesian statistic into an SNR, I think maybe it would grow like n, of the, where n is the number of detectors, grow linearly. But I'm not sure about that. That's how it works for cross-correlation. So that's my naive guess. I'm not sure.
So optimistically, in the next 10 years, what do you think is like the sort of longest signal that you could imagine looking for? Like, you know, if you wanted to talk about, for example, the super radiance instability of gravitational wave signals, which would be minutes or hours or something, is that not feasible? Could it just be too computationally complex? Or?
Well, that will be a totally different pipeline, of course. But I think there you're limited. Masha would probably be able to answer this as well. My guess is you're limited by the coherence time of this super radiant signal. So if you know where it is on the sky, if you're considering that case, then that reduces the number of templates you have to look in.
Right.
But you are assuming that it's monochromatic,
right.
And but it's not monochromatic for forever. It has some coherence time, which is determined by the Broglie wavelength, I guess, of the cloud, and that's as long as you can integrate for, and then it decoheres, and your match filter doesn't trace the signal anymore. But I don't really know too much about that.
Yeah, but just like computationally, how long do you imagine?
I mean, we have some sources that are no neutron stars that we integrate over as long as we observe for. There's no limit to how long we can track them. That's because we know everything about them, so there's just one template. That we just look for one single template, and you just make the template longer. It becomes hard when there's things you don't know about the source, and then you have to consider all these templates.
Right.
The longer the signals get, the more templates you need, and sometimes becomes intractable. All right, I'm going to move on to part three, but I'll check in at this point with Dennis and just make sure I'm doing okay with time.
Yeah. So it's now 11:10, and this part is about localization, right?
I can skip this and go to localization. The next thing would be primordial backgrounds, but I think I'm probably running over.
I think another 10 minutes is fine.
Would you prefer to hear primordial backgrounds or localization?
Localization.
One vote for localization? Anyone for primordial backgrounds?
Well, I want to vote for primordial backgrounds.
Sorry. Any other localization fan? All right. Well, we can chat over coffee. Okay, so we got a great introduction from Latham about primordial backgrounds, and as he pointed out, there are, well, I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but I think we agree probably there are two kinds. There's these inflationary models, and there are phase transitions. So you sometimes will read papers that don't label themselves as either one of these, but in practice, every background that I'm familiar with is ultimately can fall into one of these two categories. Vanilla, the basic inflationary model, we already heard about, so I guess I can skip over this, is vacuum amplification of vacuum fluctuations. And if you believe in inflation, this is generally thought to produce a background at 10 to the minus 15 in energy density. But as we heard, you can also get production of inflationary gravitational waves from preheating. So basically the idea here is that you parametrically produce particles at the end of inflation. The way I visualize this is that you have this giant, you know, particles blasting out of nowhere, and this creates quadrupole moments and creates gravitational wave backgrounds, which is different than the amplification of vacuum fluctuations, where it's the sort of quantum mechanical fluctuations of the metric itself that are getting converted into gravitational wave background. A key thing that I want to point out is that, let me say one more thing, and then I'll mention my key thing. Later in the universe, you can have phase transitions. This involves adding some new particle physics. And you need to have, as Latham told us, a strongly first-order phase transition. And the way that I usually visualize this is that during the phase transition, you make bubbles, or you know, something like bubbles, and these bubbles collide into each other. The collisions of these bubbles can create a first-order phase transition and create gravitational waves. The key thing that is important for observers to think about is to look at all these numbers. So the sort of robust prediction of inflation is that you get this low-level omega GW of 10 to the minus 15. But as we heard, only the Big Bang observers, or DeSigo plus plus, are the only detector people have proposed that can see this. The other things produce energy densities of about 10 to the minus 12 plus or minus 2. There are often papers that predict backgrounds that from the early universe that are higher than this, as high as 10 to the minus 8. But I claim that these are, you shouldn't take these seriously, and that papers that include numerical treatment of phase transitions never are able to produce backgrounds that exceed about 10 to the minus 11. And so usually ones that are higher than this are I think, I regard as optimistic, although I'd be curious to get...
I'm no expert on this.
Okay.
What accounts for the... But I know how the naive 10 to the minus 8 estimate goes. What accounts for the universality of the suppression factor?
So I have a paper about this with Tom Giblin, but basically you can assume there's some fixed energy budget to the universe, there's some efficiency factor for the quadrupolarity of the emission, and these are the first two knobs you have. You can say, well, all I have is the energy of the entire universe, and the most efficient I can make it is, you know, 100% quadrupolar in nature. And then you have to make some assumptions about the wavelength of the emission and how that compares to the size of the Hubble parameter. And that's where there's room to cheat. But if you follow numerical simulations of bubbles and early universe simulations like people like Tom do and Easter, you'd never find values that allow you to get above 10 to the minus 10 if you stretch things. Okay. But these 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 12, you can go after with third generation detectors. So you can access the early universe, and that's cool because if you saw something at audio bands, let's say 170 hertz, this is telling you about energy scales of a billion GeV. So just to put this on a cartoon, you have Big Bang nucleosynthesis, which kind of is telling you about the universe when it's 1 second old. This is kind of when the proton to neutron ratio was set. Phase transitions would happen sometime potentially much earlier than that, much higher energy scales. This is 1 MeV. Inflationary scenarios are probably happening much earlier than the phase transition, and amplification of vacuum fluctuations and preheating are, you know, roughly here after the end of inflation. So we can take a look at the sensitivity of some detectors in different bands and see, you know, how well they can measure primordial backgrounds. So here is many orders of magnitude and frequency. This is energy density, and these curves are power law integrated curves. And there's the sensitivity curves you get for stochastic backgrounds. And the way you interpret them is if a signal intersects with them just barely, then it might be detectable by at most 1 sigma. So anything that you want to detect confidently has to cross these curves. And here we have a hypothetical pulsar timing array. This is advanced LIGO. This blue one is ET. And then this kind of olive-colored one is the Big Bang Observer. Somewhere around here is where you might expect the amplification of vacuum fluctuations, which is probably the most robust prediction that I think most people, if you believe in inflation, you probably believe that this is there and can be detected, but it's, as you can see, it's below everything besides BBO. These three bands represent what Tom Giblin and I regard as the, you know, sort of range where you could plausibly get a primordial background. This is kind of without any fine tuning, is green. Red is like you get a little bit unlucky, but not, you know, it could happen. And blue is like you get a little bit lucky in terms of the way the parameters of the phase transition went. And what we find is that advanced LIGO is basically not sensitive to anything. You'd have to have some really convoluted or surprising situation for advanced LIGO to see a primordial background. Things like the Einstein telescope get down into the realistic range. But as Latham noted, you need to have this is what a first order phase transition might look like. You could have one that was quite loud, but if it's not tuned to match the band of your detector, you'd miss it. So I think primordial backgrounds are very interesting for 3G, and we should treat them seriously. But we should also understand that there could be a strongly first-order phase transition that is very effective at making gravitational waves, could be loud enough to be detectable, but in the wrong band. I added this to the slide during our discussion during Latham's talk. And I just estimated what I think our sensitivity will be for the Birmingham detector for high-frequency gravitational wave background. So there are two things that are going to make it challenging at really high frequencies. First is somewhere over here, you have a astrophysical foreground that will be hard to subtract because of post-merger signals. But then also, our sensitivity within this specific band is probably pretty poor. The reason is that energy density, this guy, scales like strain squared times F cubed. So if you say, all right, Einstein telescope is about as good at low frequencies as a high frequency detector is at high frequencies. So I'm gonna take this value of 10 to the minus 12, and then I'm gonna scale, but that's at 10 hertz, let's say, and I'm gonna scale it to 1,000 hertz. Then I take 100 as the ratio of these frequencies and I cube it. So my naive guess is if we look at how sensitive the high frequency detector is in some band around here, it's probably up here at 10 to the minus 6 or so.
Why do you say qubit? I thought you would square.
You get
an omega gravity wave is basically f over h, f over the Hubble constant squared times the power spectrum.
Yeah, so the energy density here goes like h dot squared. So each dot gives you a factor of f, and then squared, that gives you two f's. But then this d log f gives you another f. So the relationship between power spectral density and energy density has an f cubed in it.
I guess it depends. So you mean that? I guess it depends on what the thing is that you're assuming is the same between the two detectors.
H. So.
Also H. In other words, H.
H tilde. If that's the same, and then H of F is proportional to H tilde squared, and then omega of F is H of F. These are all proportionalities, f cubed.
Say it again. So that is the thing that will be the same, or that's.
So this one will be. Let's assume that this is the same across the band. So then, the square of that will be about the same. So this is the amplitude square. The absolute value. This is the amplitude spectral density, sometimes called the noise curve. This is the power spectral density, also sometimes called the noise curve. These are both the same for the two parts of the band, let's just assume, which is probably not true. Probably ET is better at low frequencies than Birmingham and friends is at high frequencies. But we'll charitably say that it's the same. But then you still get this factor of F cubed.
So when you plot these curves, do you start with low frequency? What is the low frequency cutoff?
So I just made this up. I didn't actually, this isn't a plot. I just drew it by hand. But I assumed that it's, I mean, if you drew the full curve for the Birmingham or whatever high frequency detector, it would go way down here. It wouldn't quite get down to ET, but it would get down close to here. But I don't know if I can draw this really well with my laser pointer. But you see how this one has the ET one has a peak? A trough here, that trough is telling you where most of the sensitivity comes from. So even though ET has a lot of great sensitivity at 100 hertz, because of that factor of F cubed, most of their sensitivity to the stochastic background is actually coming from 10 hertz. So most of your sensitivity would also come from slightly higher than 10 hertz, maybe 20 hertz. Because this F cubed is so strong, even if you have a nice wide flat band, you have to. You tilt it, you rotate it by this F cubed factor, and then it every noise curve, you know, goes way down. And you look at LIGO, look where that frequency is and compare that. It's well under 100 hertz. That's different than we're used to thinking about for the LIGO noise curve, which if I drew the LIGO noise curve, it would look like that, right? But when you're talking about stochastic backgrounds, everything shifts to low frequencies.
But what's the assumption here on the co-location of detectors? That kind of confuses me.
Yeah, these are assumed to be Hanford-Livingston. For the LIGO one, I'm 90% sure that ET is ET at Hanford and Livingston.
Oh, but why not ET and ET? That makes a big difference. For high frequencies, that would make a very big difference.
For high frequencies, I think that this would go up even... I think this basically is co-located, and it would go up even crazier if you...
co-located?
I think that I've drawn it about where the co-located version is. I could be wrong. And Juan actually has calculated that.
Yeah, well, I've drawn similar curves, but my curve is slightly below yours. I guess I only bypass high frequency signal and noises. I have this F card set at 1 kHz, and I was assuming co-located detectors because if this detector distance is larger than, let's say, wavelengths, then this correlation then it degrades.
Okay, so
it
assumes co-located detectors already.
Yeah, and again, to emphasize, it's just a guess, but I think it's probably right within a factor of 10.
Yeah, let's come back to the discussion session, I guess.
And if there's an overlap reduction factor, it would be probably above 1. I would guess close to 1.
So it's co-located with totally uncorrelated noise, which I think is going to be...
The takeaway message is that this is really hard to find primordial backgrounds at.
But I mean, that would be completely, I think, uncharted territory.
Yeah, that would be hard on like 3 or 4 different levels.
Yeah, unless you have a small way like this way that Eric explained.
But even then, you know, we need to wait for completely trustworthy post-merger waveforms and... should I just finish up?
No, that's fine. I'm just saying, like, maybe during the discussion session, we can come back to this when we make the numbers.
Sure, sure. Maybe we have a short coffee break for 20 minutes or so, and we come back at 11:50. Yeah.
But I think Eric still has some few more slides.
Oh. What was my last one
for
this section, and then I'll just talk about sky localization. Okay. So for people who are interested in primordial backgrounds, which I forgot to mention in my talk, but when I think about what the killer science case is for gravitational wave astronomy going into the future, I don't think that primordial backgrounds are a guaranteed source for 3G, but I think that primordial backgrounds are the holy grail of gravitational wave astronomy, and that part of a 3G program has to be seeing us as a stepping stone towards something like BBO and getting after these. I got a real frown from Yanbei, but getting at these really high distant, really distant binaries so that we can understand our foreground that we would eventually be subtracting in an experiment maybe 70 years from now, hopefully sooner, but you know. Anyway, so in that vein, we can do a lot with understanding subtraction of foregrounds now or with 3G detectors. And this is exciting for people who want to eventually go for a primordial background. And you have to be able to do this because a primordial background, if you believe me and Tom, is going to be at least 2 orders of magnitude below our astrophysical foreground. And I'll just end by saying that there are a few papers about this that are very interesting. So this one by Cutler and Harms is a kind of a classic, and they show that it's mathematically possible, though computationally extremely challenging, for Big Bang Observer to subtract every compact binary in the entire universe, but then you have residuals from your subtraction and you have to project out the residuals and it's beautiful mathematics, but it's very hard computationally. Tanya Regenbaugh and colleagues last year showed that Einstein telescope, so not BBO, but a more near future detector, will resolve enough binaries that if you subtract them out perfectly, you can get excellent sensitivity to you basically remove all of those binaries from your plot, and you would get to the kind of phase transition level. They don't investigate whether you can actually subtract them perfectly, but they show that there's this possibility. And then finally, in my paper with Rory, we discuss how you would actually do the subtraction, and and provide a framework, I think, for doing it realistically with ET. And we don't know what kind of subtraction error, you know, not systematic error, but what kind of uncertainty you inject into the measurement by trying to do the subtraction. But we should have an answer for this in the next year or so. And that's the end for.